Good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of In the Garden on KFSK. I'm your host, Daniel Rowan Tucker. On this show, we dig our hands in the dirt, get back to nature, and find that special place of abundance and beauty. Happy St. Patrick's Day, everyone. I hope you wore something green, or at least looked at something green amid all the snow and slush. I've got some Irish kin myself, and I'm lucky enough to have made two trips to the Emerald Isle, where a cousin of mine has a stone cottage overlooking the sea in County Mayo. Irish folk have always had a green thumb, as indeed they had to feed themselves on a rocky, wet, and windy island that was for a long time at the edge of the known world. Today we're going to explore some of Ireland's rich natural history and horticultural legacy, and how it relates to our somewhat similar climate and soils here in southeast Alaska. Long ago, 1,000 years or more in the past, Ireland was largely covered in a dense forest of birch, oak, mountain ash, hazel, yew, maple, elm, holly, and other trees. The rise of English military power led to Ireland being exploited as a resource colony, and after centuries of relentless woodcutting for timber and fuel, followed by more centuries of overgrazing by sheep which produced wool for export, Ireland became the largely treeless place that we see today. It's surely still beautiful for its emerald green, grassy hills and mountains, but it's important to remember that the land bears the scars of great change and loss, and stands as a cautionary tale for other places. Native woodland survives only in a few scattered little pockets, often only a couple of acres in one place. Exotic conifers like our own Sitka spruce and lodgepole pine have been introduced for timber production, and they grow prodigiously there, outmatching any native Irish species for speed of growth on windy sites with sour, boggy soil. The monocultural squares of conifer plantations have the look of an invading army in the midst of the bare and mountainous landscape, but in a few hundred years they could have groves of giant spruce trees like ours. There is a slow but steady resurgence of tree planting in Ireland, and I have faith that the forests of old will someday return in an even more diverse array of species. Where that stone cottage sits overlooking the sea is a village called Kilsala, standing at the foot of a mountain called Croagh Patrick, St. Patrick's Mountain. Kilsala is on the shores of Clew Bay, near a town called Westport in County Mayo. The landscape at this time of year is largely brown, bracken fern covering large swaths of the hillside, tussocks of windswept grass dotting the blanket bogs that slope down to the sea. And among those blanket bogs and rocky hillsides, now grazed by wandering flocks of sheep, you can still spot long rows of corrugated ridges on the land, so many that it almost looks like corrugated metal roofing in some places. These are the old lazy beds, so-called, made for growing potatoes in the 18th and 19th centuries, although there is archaeological evidence of lazy beds dating back to the Celtic era thousands of years ago, and they can be found all over northwestern Europe in places where the soil is wet and boggy in areas of high rainfall. The introduction of the potato to Ireland spurred a population boom in the west of Ireland, and this drove people to cultivate hilly and marginal lands that were previously left for grazing. A special kind of spade called a loy was traditionally used in Ireland for digging furrows and lazy beds, similar to the foot plow of the Andes, where potato growing was an ancient art. The Irish people often lacked the kind of land that allowed for easy cultivation with a horse-drawn plow, and so they resorted to the loy. The loy has a long and sharp blade shaped like the end of a butter knife or a spatula, ideal for cutting into heavy, wet soil and then levering the sod up and over into a neat furrow. To this day, Irishmen continue the art of loy digging thanks to competitions hosted by the Loy Association of Ireland, laying out neat furrows as straight as a ruler, just for the fun of it, apparently. The name Lazy Bed is certainly a misnomer, given the amount of labor it took to make them, especially on boggy or rocky hillside ground, usually working no more with than just that spade or loy. Irish farmers would dig alternating furrows and mounds anywhere from 3 feet apart up to more than 8 feet apart, running parallel to the slope of the ground so that the water could drain straight downhill and improve the condition of the soil. Good drainage, just like it is for us, is the primary limiting factor to plant growth in those peaty soils in Western Ireland, also parts of Scotland and other parts of that wet, soggy fringe of northwestern Europe, where precipitation approaches similar levels to what we get in southeast Alaska. The raised mounds of these beds were then dressed with kelp, manure, sand, and any other locally available amendments, and planted with primarily potatoes, but also oats, cabbage, carrots, and other important food crops. Even today, when they are mostly abandoned, these grass-covered lazy beds continue to show measurable differences in soil fertility and microclimate from the surrounding land, a testament to the labor and ingenuity of past generations. So keep that in mind. Working in your own garden, we know that raised beds are a really essential tool here in Petersburg, almost indispensable. We tend to make our own raised beds using lumber or metal or stone or other kinds of borders, which allows you to put them closer together, having vertical sides, and make better use of a very small space. But they can also be made in this kind of mounding fashion. And it's a good thing to keep in mind that this is a really ancient technique. Not only does it improve the drainage, it also can add a little bit of warmth to those crops by elevating things slightly off the ground, and especially in the way that they were constructed in Ireland on sloping hillsides, allowed the cold air to drain down in the furrows between the beds and marginally increase the frost-free season available to the crops growing on top of the furrows, as that cold, frosty air drain down away from them in the low ditches in between. We all know about, or most of us have heard of, the Great Potato Famine, which was a tragedy that struck Ireland in the 1840s, resulting from a combination of failure of the potato crop and also British complicity in carrying away a large amount of food from Ireland as exports, the wheat crop and other food sources being exported, and probably certain elements within the British government, which controlled Ireland at the time, being more than happy to see the large masses of Irish peasants reduce their numbers through starvation, very unfortunately. So I recommend you go back if you're curious about that. There are many firsthand accounts. It's really heartbreaking stuff, the tales from the famine from those times, and there are still monuments to that in Ireland. People certainly haven't forgotten about it. It's a very bleak chapter of history there, but important to remember. You know, we live in a time when famine in the Western world is unheard of and seems unimaginable, but you know, the occasional supply chain disruption and rising food prices give us a little reminder that, you know, the food we find at the grocery store doesn't just magically appear there, and it's a good thing to pay attention to where your food comes from and think about food security. And another important aspect of the Great Famine was that the potatoes that were being grown were largely of a single variety, a clonal variety, because they were reproduced by cuttings, and so potatoes are generally propagated clonally, which means that they're all genetically identical. this is very convenient, but the flip side is that it creates vulnerabilities in the face of pathogens. So they had this one very common potato variety. I believe they called it the Lumper, being known for producing quite a large potato. And unfortunately, a blight came along, some kind of fungal pathogen that turned the potatoes to mush in the ground and spread like wildfire among those clonally identical potato crops. And so it was able to cause great devastation in a very short amount of time. Similar things have happened with other clonal crops like the banana. We have banana varieties like the Gros Michel, I believe, that are completely extinct due to that kind of thing. So in Peru, where potatoes have been cultivated for thousands of years, they grow hundreds of different kinds of potatoes, all shapes and sizes and colors, early harvest, late harvest, everything in between. So that's a very wise strategy to cultivate that kind of diversity. It's a real hedge against pathogens and the vagaries of climate. So that's one important lesson to be learned from the history of farming in Ireland. There are a great many Irish names that grace the botanical and horticultural history of recent centuries. Many, many talented Irish plantsmen and plantswomen. For example, the lovely Oregon grape, which you can see growing down by the Forest Service building downtown, right behind the totem poles, bears the scientific name of Mahonia aquifolium, named after an Irish-American horticulturist named Bernard McMahon, who advised Thomas Jefferson and was chosen to steward the botanical collections of Lewis and Clark's expedition. And I saw recently that Mahonia has been reorganized under Berberis with the barberries, but most people, most books you're going to find still call it Mahonia aquifolium. And don't forget the lucky shamrock. Clovers fix nitrogen and enrich the soil over time. They make a great addition to your lawns and other landscapes where there's enough sun exposure to grow them. White clover is a commonly available species that seems to tolerate our acidic soils better than red clover, although amendments of lime are always going to be helpful for any of those clovers. I've seen the red clover grow to really beautiful proportions up in Hoonah, where they have better soil and limestone outcrops, and naturally more neutral pH. The red clover does really well up there. I'm sure we could grow it here as well, with proper soil amendments and drainage. But white clover also does really well. You can get a nice crop of white clover as a cover crop. If you're cultivating new ground, at the edge of a muskeg or something that you intend to turn into garden beds, or bring into production in some way, sowing a cover crop of clover just as a first step and letting it grow for a year or more, in addition to some drainage and amendments to raise the soil pH a bit, can be a really great way to go. And you could get, a foot or 2 foot high of nice lush white clover growing there, fixing nitrogen, enriching the soil in the meantime. So there's lots of things to learn from our Irish heritage. It's a beautiful country. And in many ways, the climate is very similar to here. They get a lot of rain. Western Ireland especially gets 50, 70 inches of rain or more. A lot of wind, probably more wind than we get here in Petersburg. It's more like Sitka, the outer coast, really quite windy at times. I remember climbing up a hill overlooking the village of Kilsala and seeing this birch tree growing out nearly horizontally from the side of the hill overlooking the Atlantic Ocean, just from the persistent winds coming off the sea there. And they do get much milder winters than we do, thanks to the Gulf Stream. So that's something to keep in mind as you're looking at Irish horticulture and seeing what they grow and when they plant things. Over there, it's quite common to be planting potatoes by St. Patrick's Day. They're generally well into spring by now, so I know it really stings on a year like this to think about this. They've got daffodils blooming and all kinds of things blooming in their lovely little cottage gardens. In spite of all the wind and rain, they probably haven't seen freezing temperatures for a month or more at this point, quite possibly. So they're solidly in zone 8 or even 9 out there, you know, and they can grow cabbage palms and all kinds of fun stuff like that that we can only dream of for now. But otherwise, the climate is very similar in many ways. Summers tend to be very cool and damp. It's hard to get things to dry out oftentimes, at least in the West Country there, as they say, in the west of Ireland. Another lovely Irish tradition is the Sally Garden. So a Sally is the Irish name for willows, related to the Latin name Salix that we still have for willows. Salix is the genus that willows belong to. And willows and weaving are a very ancient tradition in Ireland, willows being very easy to propagate and very tolerant of wet ground. They have been grown very widely in Ireland, and it was a tradition for Irish cottagers and farmers to have a little area of willows that they cultivated, either in one little patch closed off with a stone wall to keep out the livestock, or in a hedgerow, or in a grove down by a river or creek, someplace like that. But the Sally Garden, just as a little patch next to the cottage, can be quite ornamental. So the willows are propagated from cuttings stuck in the ground. Just imagine a piece the size of, the size of a drumstick or a piece of kindling, a chunk of willow twig set in the ground, pointing upward, of course. That's very important. It won't grow if you plant it upside down, pointing upward with the buds pointing straight up. About two-thirds or three-quarters of it in the ground with the rest sticking up above the ground. It only needs one or two buds above the ground. You want most of it in the dirt. And it will start to sprout and grow. Now, around here, the main danger to these young willow plants will be deer browsing on them or bucks raking the new shoots or the trunk. If it starts to get a bit of a trunk, the bucks will want to rub their antlers on it. So it's important to protect it from animals. And traditionally, they might close it off with a little stone wall. And they would get their willow plants started. But then in Ireland, they would coppice them to the ground, meaning cutting all the shoots back to the ground every year after the plant had a few years to get established. And so being very vigorous, these willow plants would grow long, straight shoots, as tall as your head or even more, maybe even, 8 feet tall in 1 year, depending on the variety and the conditions. And of course, your little willow patch, by your house there, you could easily fertilize it. Willows tend to have a strong appetite for nitrogen and a great love for fertile soils. So they respond well to some compost and seaweed and that kind of thing. As long as they're in full sun, that's a big requirement. They need lots of sun. So the willows in their little patch, sprouting back every year, and growing up 6-8 feet or more in a single year makes quite an ornamental effect. In the summertime, they look like these little green bushes and they get bigger and bigger and bigger. And then by the autumn, when the leaves fall, and you get some nice yellow fall colors, then through the winter, you've got these long, graceful stems, that come in all sorts of different colors. There's, willow shoots that come almost in every color of the rainbow. There's greens and yellows and pinks and reds and oranges and, really, really very attractive in the winter months. I highly recommend folks think about pruning back your willows, cutting back your willows to get that regrowth of bright colored shoots. So a whole patch of these bright colored willow shoots in the Sally Garden next to the cottage are really a nice ornamental feature. And then in the early spring before they leaf out, you would come and cut all the shoots and then have this wonderful supply of weaving material for making baskets. and all kinds of other things, which were, of course, a staple of country life for hundreds, probably thousands of years there in Ireland before the arrival of things like plastic buckets and whatnot. You had to make your own containers, and people made what they called creels or baskets. And, you know, if you've studied Irish history at all, you've seen many old photographs of an Irish farmer coming along with a donkey laden with two great woven creels full of turf or peat that they harvested to burn in their fireplace. And they were a staple of country life. So you had to have the willows so you could make things. And even some of the old fish traps and lobster traps, I believe, were woven out of willows, and sometimes also woven out of heather, which is a little plant that grows up on the bogs and the mountainsides, a little plant in the heather family, same as our blueberries and many of our other acid-loving plants. But weaving was a really integral part of the Irish tradition, and there's still quite a few Irish weavers that keep that tradition alive and make all kinds of beautiful baskets and things. You can find them online if you just Google Irish baskets and weaving and Sally Gardens. There's all kinds of lovely material there. Lots of inspiration for what can be grown even in a challenging wet climate with sour acidic soils. So for myself, I found great encouragement in my own growing efforts from knowing that only a few generations back, some of my forebears were busy hauling seaweed uphill and turning hillside bogs into vegetable gardens with patience and hard work. And no matter what your heritage is, I'm sure there's a few green thumbs somewhere in your ancestry, and you could be the next one. That's all for today, folks. Thanks for listening to In the Garden, and until next time, keep your eyes on something green.